Peter Pan as a story has been with us for over 100 years. In all kinds of adaptations, we might be most familiar with the Disney animated version, but we know that it's been every 10 years they'll come out with a new movie. There's all kinds of theatrical adaptations to Peter Pan. It started out as a book in 1911 by J.M. Barrie. And Peter Pan, we know the story, but it's about a boy that never wants to grow up. That's who Peter Pan is, and he doesn't grow up, at least within the book. And it's a book, and it's a movie, it's a theater production about childhood, and it's very thought-provoking on childhood and what childhood is and what we do in childhood. But it doesn't romanticize childhood as we tend to romanticize it. We tend to think of children as just innocent and perfect and just flawless in every possible way. And they're not. But within Peter Pan, it doesn't romanticize it in quite that way. It shows that the good and bad of it. And granted, there's a lot of good when it comes to children. There's a lot of things, and in fact, in Matthew 18, there's a certain aspect about children that we're supposed to emulate. So that's where we're going to be spending our time here in Matthew 18, verses 1 through 14. But in Peter Pan, just for instance, you see within it that with children, on the good side of the ledger, that there is a certain loyalty that children just tend to have. And that's because loyalty is, to some extent, a form of dependence. And children have no problem being loyal to people because they realize how dependent they are on others. Children, there's a certain innocence to them as well. It doesn't mean that they never do anything bad one way or the other, but there's a certain innocence when children do something bad, especially young children, it tends to be out of a lack of awareness of what really constitutes good and evil. And that can lead to mistakes and mess ups, but there's a certain innocence even within those mess ups. Whereas when adults do bad, we tend to just deliberately do bad because we want to do it. And children as well, there's a certain joy and wonder. You see this in Peter Pan all over, all the time. There's a certain joy and wonder that kids and children, they have with creation and with the world that God created, that as adults, we get old and we get jaded and we tend to lose that. There's also this underside of all of this as well that you see within Peter Pan. You see this in life as well, that the innocence of children and the carefreeness of children, it can lead to a little bit of a careless aspect that children have and can lead them to all kinds of foolish decisions that they ultimately make and get themselves into trouble. It's important that we're like children in some ways, but being like children in their carefreeness and carelessness is not one of them. Children also can actually be pretty cruel. We don't usually think of children being cruel, and it's not that they're cruel in the same way that adults are. Some adults are cruel just to be cruel. But children, sometimes in their innocence and their playfulness and just wanting to do what's fun, it can lead to them being unintentionally cruel or bringing unintentional harm to others around them. And again, this goes back to some of that innocence, that it's just, that there's just certain things that happen when there's not a good grasp of good and evil. The Bible itself, as much as, and we're going to talk about this in Matthew chapter 18, as much as we're told to be like children, and we're told to be like children in a certain specific aspect, the Bible also doesn't say that we should be like children in every aspect. Earlier in Matthew, in chapter 10, verse 16, Jesus will say, be innocent as doves, but be wise as serpents. Innocence might be a characteristic we associate with children, but wisdom and being wise as a serpent is not one of those characteristics we associate with children. That's something that we learn, we grow in as we mature. We're supposed to have both of those hand in hand. The Hebrew writer and Paul as well in 1 Corinthians, both of them, they admonish the congregations that they're talking to for being too childlike. In other words, they should have grown up, but they haven't grown up. And they're chided for not being more mature in their thinking and their growth. That brings us here to Matthew chapter 18, where even here, what we tend to remember the most, I think all of this passage is familiar to us, but what is most familiar to us is those first few verses where we're told to become children, to become like children. But the whole passage, it's not using, Jesus calls a child beside him. The disciples have asked, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus called a child to him to start making certain points. And in fact, he's going to make 3 points throughout it. He's going to say that you need to become like a child. You need to receive children and you need to, don't despise children. In other words, he makes his sermon in 3 points, which is really the precedent that we, I guess we continue now. We just make our sermons a little bit longer in every single way. But he gives this sermon. That's what we're going to be unpacking this evening. But it's interesting that what he's doing is too, he's using the example of a child, this visual representation of the child that he's brought beside him. He's using it as a metaphor, but it's a little bit of a moving metaphor. It's a metaphor for how us as Christians, what we should become like. There's a certain aspect of children, their humility, their lowliness that we should become like. But then he also uses children as a metaphor for how we should also see others, especially others within the congregation and others within the church and others within our family. We're supposed to see others as children, especially when they're stumbling and falling and failing. These are the characteristics of childhood that we shouldn't necessarily emulate in our lives, but they're characteristics when we see in other people that we should have the love for them as we would have for a child who does these same types of things. And so for us this evening, we'll go through that, verses 1 through 14, and talk about becoming a child, receiving children, and also not despising children. In chapter 18, verses 1 through 6, chapter 18, verses 1 through 4, we'll reread that, and we'll talk about becoming like a child. Matthew writes, at the time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, truly, I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So first of all, this whole scene, it starts out with this question. The disciples, it's a question that comes up time and time again. Who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And it's no... The timing of the question, it's not accidental. Just earlier in chapter 17, verses 22 through 23, Jesus has told them one of the several times that he'll tell them that I'm about to die and I'm going to be raised from the dead. And so the disciples, when they're asking him who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, it's not just for they just want some personal knowledge of it, but there's an implication here that whoever's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven is going to be the one that's going to rule once Jesus is no longer here. And that's a very valid question in some ways. What are we going to do when Jesus is not here? But this question starts coming up more and more. A couple of chapters later, it's going to be John and James, and they're going to get Mama involved, asking and trying to position them on the left hand and right hand of Jesus. So this is a very pertinent question for the disciples, because it's one thing to submit themselves to Jesus, but I don't want to be submitting myself to Peter because he just yaks all the time, or I don't want to be submitting myself to John or James because they seem to have this hot temper all the time. The disciples are trying to figure out, it's not just about having knowledge of, they're not okay with submitting just to anyone. They want to know and they want to make sure who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven for their own personal reasons. And you can sense within the question, there's no innocence in it. That what they're ultimately doing is that they're equating, they're seeing visibility and power as something that's valuable and should be sought. There's a little bit of ego-drivenness about the question of who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus is going to answer, but before he answers, there's a point for us in our lives, because we see this all around us all of the time, that just in the work we do, in the positions that we might have, that we know that there are certain people, like these disciples seem to be doing, that seek for leadership positions or management positions or seek to be in a higher position simply because of the status and the value that those types of positions have. In fact, we can even run the risk of doing that ourselves when we have no business or have no care for the people that might be under our charge, but we care more for having a position of leadership or having a position of status. And always, and you see it here, that when we seek to when we get into a mode where we seek to be served as opposed to serving others, it leads to all kinds of problems, and it ends with something that's bad for the people that are actually under our charge. And so Jesus responds. He recognizes that the question is a bad question, because there are really bad questions. There's not, every question is not a valid question. That's just what we like to tell ourselves, because we say bad questions a lot of times. But Jesus' response lets them know that, okay, you asked a bad question, but I'm going to give you the answers that are the right answers to the questions that you should have been asking. And his answer is ultimately to become like a child. And he specifies exactly how they're to become like a child. They're not to become like a child in the fact in children's self-control. Hopefully, but not always, adults should have more self-control than children. They're not supposed to become like children in their wisdom, because hopefully adults should be wiser than children are. But they're supposed to become like children. Verse 4, he says, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Children, this is the aspect of children that they're supposed to emulate. They care about their ego-driven, who's the greatest, who's the greatest. And Jesus' response is, become like a child who in their lives, they look up to everyone. This is actually part of their survival. The reason that children are dependent on other people, or the reason that children are lowly, and the reason that children are fine following others, is because they recognize that they depend on others for all kinds of things. And they recognize that without people to help them in some type of way, there's no way that they could survive or they would be able to get on by themselves. It's part of the reason, again, why children are so loyal and why adults have a hard time being loyal to people, because we think that we can do it all ourselves and we don't think that we need anybody for that. And God is essentially, and Jesus is saying to them to be like a child in their lowliness, to recognize that we're dependent upon God, but also we're dependent upon one another. And each of the disciples, they're dependent on one another and each other. And that's something they're going to have to learn once Jesus is not around anymore as well, how dependent they are on each other, and how within a church, how dependent we are on one another. And being okay to serve under somebody and not constantly feeling that we have to be the boss or the one in charge. Jesus gives an answer, and his answer, it also comes with a consequence. He says in verse 3 that unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven, which has that's a pretty tough consequence. And it's a pretty shocking consequence as well, because if you're a disciple, or even if you're sitting on this side, you're reading into the Bible, you're thinking, well, aren't these disciples already in the kingdom of heaven? How will they, are they not in it? And how will they not enter in if they don't become like children? And what Jesus is saying is he's not making a statement from which that he's not saying something so that forever after we constantly have to be calling into question, am I saved or am I not saved? Am I in the kingdom of heaven or am I not in the kingdom of heaven? The kingdom of heaven itself also, just by the way, is a reference to God's rule. And the kingdom of heaven, it's not something that we just enter into when we die. It's something that we enter in, we choose to enter in right now through faith and ultimately within the church through baptism and repentance. But the kingdom of heaven, the point that he's making is that it's not so much that God's going to kick you out of the kingdom of heaven or block the way, but by your own attitude, if you don't adopt the position of a child and the lowliness of a child, you can essentially step outside of the rank and the role that you're supposed to be in, and you can deliberately place yourself outside of the kingdom of heaven yourself. This is kind of like in the military. Within our society, the military is really one of the last places where puts a high value on authority and following instructions and doing what you're commanded to do. And the reality of that is because they have to, because at the end of the day, in the military, it's a life and death matter, whether you follow orders or whether you don't follow orders. And if you don't follow orders, and if you step outside of the rank that you are, then you not only put your life in jeopardy, but you put everybody else's life in jeopardy as well. And like in the military, if a private tried to supersede his sergeant, or if a private tried to supersede a captain or the general, he can very deliberately, he would essentially very deliberately be placing himself out of that military service. In the same way, this is what Jesus is getting at. If you don't become like a child, if you don't recognize your lowly position, if you don't act lowly and recognize that other people are more important than yourselves, then what you will be doing is placing yourself by your own will outside of the kingdom of heaven, because that is not how it works within the kingdom of God. And so he says to become like a child in your humility. And then he moves on from there. He's using this metaphor of this child that's sitting beside him. And he's using it and applying, like all preachers do, to different types of scenarios. And he goes on from there in verses 5-9. Jesus continues on. He says, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone fastened around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world for temptations to sin, for it is necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one by whom the temptation comes. And if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than with two hands or two feet to be thrown into the eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into the hell of fire. And so Jesus says, okay, you asked a question, and I already gave you an answer and a consequence if you don't follow that answer. But let me do this again. Let me give you another answer to the question that you really should have been asking. And I'll give you a consequence there as well. And the answer this time that he gives them is, whoever receives a child in my name receives me. It's important for us to receive children. And it's important for us to recognize that what's happening here is he's using this child as a metaphor. And there's multiple layers of meaning here. On one hand, he is very much talking in a very literal sense that everything that he's instructing us to do here applies to how we treat children, real flesh and blood children, 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds and on and on and on. All of this applies to that. But what Jesus is also hitting at is that I'm not just talking about my children. I'm talking about all of God's children, all of God's family. I see them as my children, and especially those who are young in the faith and those who might. He's going to be talking about children who do stumble and do fall away and do stray away. And he's saying, and he's giving a consequence for it, you receive these children and you do not do anything that could offend them or cause them to stumble. And it's important that he's saying this. And the way he says it, what's happening is that he says, if you receive a child, you receive me. Which also reminds us of the fact that throughout the Gospels, especially in the Gospel of John, one of the things that Jesus will do is he'll say that if you receive me, you'll receive God the Father. But now he's saying, he's going further back. If you receive a child, you'll receive him. So if you receive a child, you'll receive Jesus and you'll receive God the Father as well. Which is a pretty impactful statement. And it goes back to one of the Ten Commandments. This is in the Ten Commandments. We weren't supposed to. One of the Ten Commandments is not to make a graven image of God. And there's a lot of reasons that we could unpack as to why that's the case. But one of the reasons that we're not supposed to make graven images of God is because in mankind, God has already put his stamp and his image on other human beings. And when we create things out of the creation, animals and other things to serve, and when we serve money and other types of idols, it takes our focus away and it ultimately causes us to harm the actual image bearers of God that are in the world. And this is an allusion that Jesus is making, that my children, they are my... In some way, when we receive children, we receive God. Children are in the image of God just as much as people are, and we're to receive them. And the act of receiving, it's actually talking about humility, just receiving. The focus has turned from us to how we see others and other Christians. But the act of receiving another Christian, especially another weak Christian, it's actually an act of humility on our side as well. It causes us to be childlike. Because when you receive someone, when you receive another weak Christian, when you receive someone else, you're receiving them with a lot of the baggage that comes with it, with some of their weaknesses, with some of the things that you'll have to help them with and through. It's much like a host. If you're a host and you're a good host and you're having someone into your home, a good host, you make for guests, you accommodate those guests. If there's certain cultural things that you might need to accommodate, you do that. If there's certain foods that you need to be accommodative to, a good host will do that. If there are certain topics at the dinner table that you really need to avoid as a host because that's just not going to fly with the person that you're sitting with, that's an act of receiving. That's an act of humbling yourself or humiliating yourself so that you can ultimately receive someone and not offend them or not cause them to stumble. And this is why this directly leads into what Jesus says, that if you don't receive, if you aren't like this, if you aren't like that good host that's receiving and accommodating, and you ultimately cause one of these little ones to sin, if you cause one of these little ones to stumble, the consequence is pretty harsh. It'd be better if you had a millstone tied around your neck and dropped in the sea. In other words, death would be a better fate than the fate that awaits if we cause one of God's little ones to stumble. One of the ways as Christians that we can unintentionally step over the line on this is when we start thinking too much about my freedoms and what I'm allowed to do, as opposed to thinking about our freedoms as something that in some cases we actually need to restrict for the benefit of others. Our freedoms can get us in trouble a lot of times. This is our freedoms. We have a lot of freedoms as Christians. This is something that runs throughout the Bible. But sometimes, just like in the Corinthian church and the Roman church as well, the eating of meats was a problem, which Paul was willing to restrict for the sake of others. And we know when we're treading on this line, when constantly what's on our mind all of the time are questions like, can I do this? Or can I do that? Or can I do this? Can I do that? Is this okay? There's a time and place for those types of questions, and I'm not going to specify what lies at the end of those questions. Can I do X? Can I do Y? Because that would defeat the whole purpose of even talking about this in the first place. But we have to recognize that when we start talking in these types of terms, can I do this? Can I do that? What we're ultimately doing is we're asking to see where are those boundaries and what are the uttermost limits of those boundaries that I can push to and that I can behave myself on. We're thinking about ourselves, and we're not necessarily thinking about anybody else other than ourselves. And the reality of the matter is sometimes the boundaries that might be okay for us to push to would be completely disastrous or devastating if anyone else engaged in the same type of thing. If anyone else started asking those same types of questions and participating in the same types of things. Let me give you an example of this. With children, a parent recognizes that you can ride a bike. It's okay to ride a bike, and to even, if there's no sidewalk, it's okay to ride a bike on the street. There's a safe way to do that, of course. But you don't ride a bike on the street and then allow your 3-year-old to ride their bike on the street by themselves. There's certain limits that are okay, certain boundaries that it's okay for adults to engage in that for kids would be completely disastrous. There's certain foods that parents might realize, okay, it's okay for me to eat this, but for my kid, it could actually be harmful or just be devastating in nap time, and I don't want to deal with it. There's certain things that parents can do that kids can't, and we recognize that. That's called wisdom, knowing the difference between those types of things. But the point for us as Christians is not that we can't ever ask those questions of can I do this, can I do that, but we have to recognize those questions can also be dangerous. And the more important question in each and every circumstance is should I do this or should I do that? If Paul can give up meat for the sake of other weaker brethren, there might be some things that we might need to give up for the sake of others that it could harm. And at the end of the day, he says that the consequences, it's important that we eliminate the things that cause suffering in others. And that's what he's saying in verses 7 through 9, that it would be better to cut off your hand or gouge out your eye and enter into the kingdom of heaven without those things, and to be cast into hell with those things. And this is the part, the reason that Jesus is emphasizing it in such, in doing it in such radical terms is because he's driving home the point to us. He's driving home to the point to us that he cares for his little children. And frankly, we care for little children as well. But this is the point that Jesus is making, that there's a special place that little children, that weak Christians, that people that are struggling with sin, that there's a special place that they have in Jesus' heart. And it's very much the same with us as well. We can listen to a news story, and if someone dies in the news story, it can be tragic and it can upset us. But anytime a child is involved and a child's death is involved in some type of news story or something we hear, we all recognize that there's a different level of anger that comes when injustice happens to a child, when injustice happens to a kid. And this is why Jesus is channeling that fury into what he says to them, saying it'll be better if you drown than if you did this and got away with it. It would be better. You need to make sure that you, if your hand offends you, to cut it off, or your eye offends you, to gouge it out, rather than to have those cause stumbling to you or to others. That's a passage that a lot of times what we like to do with a lot of the harsh sayings of Jesus, we like to preface that first of all. We like to say that Jesus is not really being literal here. But what he's really saying is X, Y, Z. And so since everybody says that already, let me just push back against that. Since maybe I'm the only one that'll say this, but Jesus really is saying that if it's really your hand that's causing you all of the problems, if it's really your hand, that if that's gone and you're going to be okay and free from sin, then you better do that. If it's really the eye that's causing the suffering, and if it's really the eye that's going to mess you up every single time, then you better get rid of that as well. But the problem is that it's usually actually deeper than those things. And the thing and the real sin, it always sits below that. That the hand or the eye, if it's really going to solve the problem, then go ahead and do it. But it's always something below the surface, even below that, that's really causing the sin. And Jesus is saying that let me make this clear to you. If it's important enough that I would tell you to lose your hand or your eye over it, then you better get rid of the actual thing that's below all of that, that's causing the sin and the stumbling for you and for others, because this is how much I hate sin and how much I really hate the fact that you're hurting other people, that and you're hurting my own children. But as Christians, we're to receive children as we receive Jesus, and we're supposed to not give cause to offense for them. And he goes on from there in verses 10 through 14 to finish that out. He says, "See that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I tell you that in heaven, their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly I say to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. So it is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish." Jesus gives a final answer. Again, the disciples have asked this question, who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus said, okay, wrong question. That's a bad question. Let me give you a few answers as to let me give you the answers to the questions that you really should have been asking in the first place. And he says that do not despise one of these little ones. But that's an answer that actually begs the question a little bit. That begs the question of why would someone despise one of these little ones in the first place? Why would someone despise a child? And this gets to something that we've talked about a little bit already, but we'll hit more now. The children, they're not perfect. Children make mistakes. Children do bad things sometimes that are frustrating things. And what Jesus is saying is like a good parent who still loves his child in spite of those mistakes. And sometimes the reality is some of those mistakes are actually endearing. When a child makes a mistake and then really realizes they made a mistake, but then they just keep making the mistake over and over. There's a somewhat endearing aspect of some of the cluelessness of children sometimes. And he's saying that you treat other people in that type of way. Not that you just ignore the mistake, or not that you don't try to correct the mistake, but that you have the same compassion on them as you would on a child. This is something that last month, I guess it was, or maybe it was early this month when we finished Jonah. This is what we see in Jonah. This is how God finishes out the book of Jonah. Part of the reason in Jonah 4 that he has so much compassion on these Ninevites is because they're like these little children who don't know their left hand from their right hand. And they're so clueless in their innocence. But when they're presented with the truth, at the end of the day, they do repent. For all their wickedness, they ultimately repent and turn their lives around. And what Jesus is saying is, be like that loving parent. The reality is that there's flesh and blood parents who do despise their kids because they don't want to put in the time to bring them up or to nurturing them or to educating them or to helping them in all of the ways that a child needs in order to grow. But Jesus is saying, be the type of parent that loves their children, that cares for their children, and do not despise one of these little ones. And it comes, again, with its own consequence. So this is, although this, it's a little bit of a veiled consequence here. He says in verse 10, do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that in heaven, their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. So striking verse. It reminds us of something else that we covered maybe last month as well in Psalm 91, where the psalmist says that God will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. God's angels, to whatever capacity that happens, whether that's on a very individual basis, we see throughout the scripture that angels tended to be representatives of certain nations. And whether each of us in some type of way has our own representative angel in heaven for us or not, We see throughout the Bible in these hints and spaces here and there that God's angels minister to us and they help us in some ways that we can't even see. And the veiled threat here is that God's little children have angels up in heaven who constantly, day by day, see the face of God. And the idea is that they're reporting back to God and they're in communication with God. And if we're the ones that hurt or cause harm to one of God's little children, and the blood's going to be on us because God's going to know about it. And their representatives are in heaven, ultimately appealing for the justice against that. At the end of the day, we need to see children. He uses that example of sheep. There's no mistake that he uses the example of sheep. Sheep are not known for having just vast amounts and wells of wisdom. But sheep are known for being loyal, for knowing that they're dependent on someone and for following. And sheep, of course, can stray and can go astray, but sheep, they'll follow. And ultimately the chief shepherd is God and Jesus himself. But we're supposed to have compassion on the sheep of the flock and on Christians and on that one sheep that falls outside of the flock that we should go rescue, that we should give up everything that we have to go and find. Just as in Jonah, that God, he, even with Jonah, with all his surliness and with all his cantankerousness and leaving and going away, God goes from Nineveh to try to bring Jonah back to the fold. And this is hard stuff for us because when there's other Christians that are failing or when there's other Christians that are weak and when there's other Christians that are hurting in some type of way, going after that one sheep means that that's going to require some work. It doesn't require any work. You can be complacent with the 99 sheep that are content to stay where they are. But when we are jarred from our complacency and are jarred from our passiveness and actually have to do what we were called to do in the first place, that's hard. That's tough for us. But that's what God's asking us to do, to be like God, to be like Jesus, to have that same type of love for others and that same type of care where we're willing to bend over backward to bring back that one sheep to God. Because as Jesus says in verse 14, it's the will of my Father who is in heaven. It is not the will of my Father in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. Because Jesus and God, the Holy Spirit, they don't want any of us to perish. They want all of us to be able to call ourselves children of God. This is the purpose of Jesus' sacrifice, so that not only Jesus Christ himself would be a son of God, but through all of us, through participation in his blood and baptism into it and being raised from that water, so that we ourselves could be children adopted into that kingdom of what as well, sons and daughters. So the invitation is for us, if we need to call ourselves a child of God, if we haven't ever called ourselves a child of God, or if we've been children in the kingdom, but we have placed ourselves deliberately outside of that and we need to return to it, please come forward as we stand and sing.
Upon the